Moncrief on News Talk.
It is time for Movies and Booze. Fionnuala Jones, Jean Smullen and Chris Wasser. Join us once again. Good afternoon.
Hello.
To you all.
Hi guys.
What are we looking at today, Jean?
I was on a trip to Spain, but actually we're looking at Spain
like
for the
recently?
White. Yeah, just this week I was in Rioja and Ribera del Duero.
What temperature?
Oh my God. Look, the ankles are still swollen. Yeah, we're on radio, but
yeah,
believe me.
Yeah.
And then there was a riot at Madrid airport because there was nobody manning the passport. Now, it wasn't in the terminal we were in, but we were reading these news, right? All the Guardias Civiles were called in because all the annoyed passengers were kicking off.
Yeah.
But it took us nearly an hour and a half to check in. It was nuts. It was completely nuts. But the heat was unbelievable.
Well, the heat probably wouldn't have helped.
No. And that's what made everybody cranky, of course, you know. And I literally got off the plane, and when I got the waft of cold air, I practically got down and kissed the ground and said, I'm never leaving Ireland again. Seriously. Really. We don't know what we're on to here with our
climate change for you. Yeah. So, anyway, obviously,
4th of July, we're going to do Californian Zinfandel.
Okay, right.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah. For the day that's in it.
Yes, a day to celebrate.
It was a bit ropey choosing it, but then I thought, well, you know, you got to give them a shot, you know.
Yeah.
And I've got some interesting stats actually about who their key markets are, and it's like Canada and Europe.
Good luck with that.
Yeah.
I should think so. Jurassic World Rebirth. How can you continuously remake the same film and try and convincingly sell the idea that, oh, we have no knowledge of how it went horribly wrong the last time.
You can't. But for some reason, every time these films come around, people seem to forget that the one before it was terrible and they make a fortune. Because the last three, the Jurassic World trilogy, the one with Chris Pratt, I think a total box office haul of like 3.5 billion. Something like that,
gosh,
which is more than the original films made. So this is Rebirth. It's the seventh Jurassic film. It has nothing to do with the others, but it's got a brand new cast. It's sort of like someone is pressing the refresh button.
Yeah.
And I will get into it later, but I will say this. It's better than the other three we got before. It actually passes the time better than you'd expect. they can have that one. They can put that on the poster.
That's one for the poster.
Yeah, definitely.
Better than the other rubbish.
And the other film is a new one from David Cronenberg, the master of body horror, who about 7 or 8 years ago, he lost his wife, film editor Caroline Zeffman, and he said that he had been developing some sort of autobiographical, but a personal project about grief and about a man who loses his wife. And this is the resulting film. It's the first film that he's worked on without her in decades, obviously.
Okay.
And it is about a man who loses his wife and goes to very peculiar lengths to preserve her memory. So a dino film and a film about love beyond the grave.
Okay. So, but it doesn't sound like it's a straightforward autobiographical film. It's Nobody needs to see that. And Michael Madsen died.
He was young, 67. People know him, obviously worked extensively with Quentin Tarantino, The Kill Bills, Reservoir Dogs. Very sad, he was found in his Malibu home unresponsive. They believe it right now it's cardiac arrest, but unconfirmed. Lots of nice tributes coming in from previous co-stars like Walton Goggins, calling him an icon. Jennifer Tilly, so the same one of my favourite actors I ever worked with. Billy Baldwin said, fitting that Michael Madsen would pass away on 4th of July weekend. He was no firecracker, a total stick of dynamite on screen and in life. Rest easy, my friend. Very sad news.
Yeah. Did he fulfill his potential?
I mean, because at the time, like, you know, they're talking about like he's working on a lot of like independent film and stuff like that. But yeah, I think there is a question of that potentially. Also very keen poet, like wrote a lot of poetry and stuff like that.
Yeah.
Maybe he just didn't want the...
Well, yeah, well, I know it may have been a bit, say, you know, well, all the reporting on him has, you know, cited films he was in, but it was like 20 years ago kind of thing.
He did lots of bit parts in iffy TV series in America as well, you know, so.
Yeah, very much a jobbing actor in the latter part of his career, and also maybe a victim of typecasting. But at the same time, most actors would give their right arm to have the defining cinema moments that he had in the 90s.
Yeah.
Like, to have a seen, you know, to be in Reservoir Dogs, but to be involved in scenes that he had in that film that are so iconic and that people still quote and talk about, and to have that effect, yeah, you'd kill for that.
Yeah, that's a legacy.
Yeah, that's true. Now, I'm glad my mom died, which is the name of a memoir, just not a personal expression by anybody here. But like that, a memoir was huge, and Jennifer Aniston is now attached to it.
Yes, I'm very excited about this. So as you said, yeah, I'm Glad My Mom Died is a memoir by Jeanette McCurdy, who people might not be familiar with. Child star on Nickelodeon, would have been opposite Miranda Cosgrove in iCarly, I suppose, her most iconic role. Iconic, maybe not the right word, but like her biggest role, we'll say. She came out with this memoir in 2022 that basically detailed this relationship that she had with her mother that was very much abusive, and the road to recovery that she needed to take after kind of experiencing this and following her death. I kind of want to give too much away because it is like genuinely such a brilliant memoir from kind of someone you wouldn't expect, because she's not quote unquote a huge star. But if you haven't read it, definitely go read it. But yeah, as you said, Jennifer Aniston is signed on to play her mother. I don't think it's a direct adaptation of it. Like, they're kind of describing it as like this dramedy of this kind of 18-year-old actress. She's gone huge on a hit kids show. So, I mean, like, so far, so true to life.
Yeah.
And she's dealing with this narcissistic mother played by Jennifer Aniston, who's kind of relishing in this identity of being her mom. So this is coming to Apple TV Plus. I don't think we have dates yet. We're working on it alongside showrunners that have worked on like Rami and Jerry Carmichael's reality show. Aniston's also executive producing. This is going to be one to watch, I would say, and there would be high hopes for it, and I hope they do a good job with it, because look, and Jeanette McCurdy is involved herself and like seems to be very excited about this. Be interesting to see Aniston kind of take this on, being like full kind of baddie.
I could see her do that.
Oh no, I could. No, that's why I
absolutely,
like,
see her do that.
I'm like quietly like confident about it. But yeah,
but I think Jeanette McCurdy, when she was on iCarly, was much younger than 18.
Yes, no, she would have been. Yeah. And like, again, the memoir is interesting because Nickelodeon has had this kind of reckoning around allegations around inappropriate behavior on set and stuff like that. And it's something that she kind of talks about, but like not in huge detail. So you'd be wondering how much they're going to get into that as well.
Yeah.
So,
well, I suppose if it's only based on, they have a bit more latitude there.
Yeah.
To explore that thing. Maybe. Yeah. It's interesting making that character 18.
Yeah.
Maybe makes it slightly different, or maybe gives him a bit more attitude.
Yeah.
And again, to seriously icky territory.
Yeah. Because she was so young when you think about it. It was just insane.
And the amount, like, because I remember my kids watching that. They're like, how many of them did they churn out? Their work load must have been absolutely unbelievable.
Yeah, insane. I think it's probably one of the most, if not the most successful, like, Nickelodeon, like, original export, because it ran for a couple of seasons. I'm sure they tried to reboot it in the most recent era. Mm. Jeanette didn't come back for it, but I think a lot of the original cast did for two seasons with Paramount, and that was cancelled. Mm. So it has this kind of long tail in popular culture, for sure.
Yeah. What does Jennifer McCurdy do now?
What is she doing now? I think because I could be wrong in this, but I'm 90% sure she has another book deal off the back of this memoir. I think it might be fiction. I'm not really sure. And obviously she's involved with this, but I'm not sure if she's any kind of real like desire to go back to acting per se. And you can understand why she wouldn't, again, if you're familiar with the memoir, but
100%, you can understand that. Right, Jean, tell us about our first one.
Okay,
please.
Right. We're over in Catalonia, in the region of Penedès, which is south of Barcelona. And interesting enough, this is the first wine region in the world to produce 100% organic wine. So this one is organic and vegan. It's called Mont Ruby. The vintage is 2024.
When they say vegan, like, it's not like they're, you know, putting rashers into wine normally.
Fine wines will use egg white.
Okay.
For fining. And, you know, so basically they use a process involving a sort of an earth-based product to take the bits out of the floaty bits out of the wine. So it's nothing too strenuous, but it's now become a selling point, right?
Okay. And what do they use instead then for the fining if it's organic?
They use this earth,
Oh, right. Yeah,
It's called Pisagor. Yeah. They use some kind of beef-based products is another, the non-organic.
Yes.
Those awful people.
Terrible.
You know, so anyway. But I think it's just become a big marketing tool now, to be really honest with you, like a lot of things. So anyway, we're in the, these guys, Penedès is going to be the first wine region in the world. It's going to be, you can't be a member of the DO unless you're producing sustainable wines, which is a good thing. So a little bit about this. This is an award-winning organic wine. The winery has mostly high-altitude vineyards, 800 metres above sea levels, about 60 kilometres from Barcelona. And it was founded in 1984, but they're actually growing. The grapes, the vines are actually were first planted in 1974, so they're 51 years old. When I read that and said 51, I went, oh my God, you know. I think I did my intercert in 1974. That's kind of scary, but anyway. So this is Exarello. Now, Exarello is one of the three grapes used in the production of cava. And it's not a grape that's kind of mainstream, which is why I actually like this. It's a thick-skinned white grape, and one of the characteristics is high acidity. And acidity, I mean, seriously, it's all about acidity now. If white wine drinking has gone through the roof. And when we were in Spain this week, we were at Bodega Felix Solas, which is one of like the fourth biggest producers in the world. You know, they are enormous. And they were telling us, you know, we're producing a lot more white wine because that's what the market wants. That's what people want to drink. So red wine drinking is starting to sort of fall off a cliff. So it's all about white. So they're going out.
Not if I have anything to do with it.
You and me both, Sean. Trust me. No. Yeah, red. Like, honestly, I love red too. But basically, very acidic white grape. So using, you know, it's quite like in the blend, it brings kind of high levels of acidity. You know, it's thick skinned. So it probably, you know, gives it more sort of comprehensive flavor. So, you know, they said, well, let's make this as a single varietal and see how it flies. And it flies very well, to be very honest with you. Because it's a thick skin grape, you're getting more texture from this particular wine. Lots of stone fruit flavour. There's a slightly vegetal balsamic character to it. But I just think it's a lovely.
It's lovely.
Yeah, I mean, I've seen a few of Jean Leon, which is who's another producer. It's one of the Torres. It's owned by Torres. They also make a single varietal Exarello as well. So this is a great variety worth keeping an eye on. Now, spelling it's Xarel-LO. So
yeah, that's very Catalan.
On a label as well. So yeah, Mont Ruby White, and it's available in Whelan Wines, which is up there on the Bray Road, the Silver Tassie, iconic place, Loughlin Sound. You also get it online at whelanwines.ie, and definitely worth a punt this weekend.
Okay, cool. Chris, shall we bring people the shock news that dinosaurs are actually dangerous?
I think we should.
So brace yourselves. Dinosaurs coming next.
Look, this island was a laboratory of sorts. They conducted experimental work here.
What kind of experiments?
Crossbreeding of species, engineered entertainments, they call them.
Genetically altered freaks?
Any that were malformed or just too damn hard for anybody to look at. We left them here.
Well, that's inhuman. Why not just euthanize them?
The average cost of a created species is $72 million. What would you do? Kill it and have to tell your bank or just carry it forward under R&D?
What would I do with mutant dinosaurs from an accounting perspective? Is that really the question?
Well, $72 million.
Yeah.
Yeah, I prefer the money. Thanks very much. So, are they starting from scratch all over again, or how do they kind of...
Sort of. So it has been 32 years since, you know, John Hammond's brought dinos back from the dead. It's been 32 years since Steven Spielberg and David Koepp brought them back from the dead. And, you know, this story does exist in the same world as Alan Grant and Jeff Goldblum and Laura Dern.
Yeah.
But it's very much its own thing. And it sets up shop in this world where it's very meta, very self-aware, because, you know, this is a Jurassic World film that's trying to surprise audiences for, you know, the opening time and try to make them excited about dinosaurs despite the fact that we've kind of seen everything.
Yeah.
So we're very much in a world where dinosaurs are boring. And all the theme parks have closed, like, because there were spin-off Jurassic theme parks. You know, there are dino zoos in America because dinosaurs, remember, in the Jurassic World films, they kind of just branched out. They left the islands. They went to live among the humans, which wouldn't end well. But they're all dying out because of the atmosphere, because of the conditions, because humans keep killing them. So the remaining dinosaurs are all transported to, you know, around somewhere around the equator, all of these remote locations where, you know, the environments they'd be better suited to. And they'd be left alone there. Or so you think.
Okay.
But this oily big pharma guy comes in, played by Rupert Friend. His name is Marcus. And he says, we figured out, and you know, they never really explain how they figured this out, but we figured out that dino blood could cure heart disease. And so we need a sample. And we don't just need a sample from any dinosaur. We need a sample from a land dinosaur, a sea dinosaur, and an air dinosaur. Three adventures, Sean, straight away.
Okay.
So he goes to this ex-military covert operative play. I know. It gets better.
Here's the biggest syringe you've ever seen in your life.
That's it.
Jump in there.
There's three syringes. And each syringe, each hypodermic needle has a parachute that once you fire it into the dinosaur, when it's finished collecting the blood, the syringe goes and then someone has to catch it.
Cool.
You don't catch it. I mean, it's a lot of effort for nothing. But anyway, you've got this covert operative, you've got this mercenary played by Scarlett Johansson, and in the biggest wink to the audience that I've ever seen in a summer blockbuster, she says no at first because she's too good for this. But then they say, what if we pay you 10 to 20 million, which is Scarlett Johansson's price tag? And she does it.
Okay.
So she does it, but she says, I'm going to, you know, assemble my crew. She gets Jonathan Bailey, who's this brilliant and handsome paleontologist. You know, the kind of guy who says that, I don't think we should do this, but again, someone gives him a check and says, I think we should do this.
For presumably less than $20 million.
I mean, he was good in Wicked, but he's not Scarlett good.
Yeah.
And then we also have Mahershala Ali, who really, really, really should be doing better things with his time, but he's decided to play a charismatic boat captain here, and he's very good. This is actually one of the first Jurassic Park films where when you see ads on the side of the buses or posters, it's not just about the dinosaurs. You have the actors' names above. Yeah, that's
featuring
the
people you've heard of.
Yeah, but that's the power of Scarlett Johansson, that she actually gets top billing over T-Rex. So once they get to the island, we need a family. The T-Rex is not going to chase after just scientists. The T-Rex wants to chase after families. So this family, this random civilian family, is just shoehorned into the tale. You've got this family has just gone for a boat trip. The boat trip went wrong, and they end up on this island in the middle of the science guys, and chaos ensues. They also come across this lab where InGen, which was the company that brought the dinosaurs back to life, they weren't just bringing dinosaurs back to life, they were experimenting with them. They created mutant dinosaurs, Sean. So in this film, you don't just have a T-Rex, you don't just have a Velociraptor, you don't just have a Spinosaurus, you have a Distortus Rex. It has six limbs.
Cool.
And it has a big alien head. And also, I love the fact that in this film, you also get to see a T-Rex swimming. But I should say, I spent far too long thinking about how that would work. Little arms. What do you
do? Just a sinking below the waves.
I was laughing at the press screen. I think people were like, why is he laughing? People are getting their heads ripped off here. You know what? It sounds as though I'm making fun of this film a lot. I am. It is ridiculous. It's just insane that we still are here 32 years later watching the same things over and over again. It's not bad. It's a decent adventure film. It does something which I'm not doing right now. It shuts up. It actually, you know, for 20 minutes at a time, it's all about this lean, focused, very well-staged action. You haven't got overpaid actors standing around talking about human cloning, talking about the repercussions.
Yeah.
It's just let the dinosaurs chase the scientists. It's actually really well performed. It's directed by a guy named Gareth Edwards, who made a Star Wars film, Rogue One, probably one of the best Star Wars films of the last 15 years. He also made a Godzilla film, the best Godzilla film, the original one of the reboots. And he knows how to blend, you know, gripping, you know, not very well written, but gripping human drama all the same with that, you know, blockbuster size madness. So I think he handles it well. I think it's well performed. It doesn't have the same. I was kind of thinking of the original film this week. You remember in the original film when Laura Dern sees the Brachiosaurus for the first time? And Grant falls over and he can't believe they have a T-Rex. And then there's that wonderful line where Jeff Goldblum says, he did it. That crazy son of a bitch did it. I always thought like that. He's not just talking about Hammond there. We're actually talking about Spielberg and that ability that Spielberg had to just completely floor the audience.
Yeah.
You know, the characters just weren't amazed by it. I remember going to see it and thinking, how did they do this? They've repeated that trick so many times now that you're just a bit numb now when you see the dinosaurs. So you can tell that they're straining themselves here to try and impress us. It doesn't have the same magic and awe and wonder as the rest of them. But if we are to keep having sequels to, you know, beloved classic films, we could do a lot worse than this.
Okay, yeah. Because that moment in the first Jurassic Park movie is a bit like in Jaws. Because you don't see where the head suddenly rears out, you know, we're going to need a bigger boat. That moment. But it's very hard to replicate that.
It is very hard to replicate it. Yeah. But look, I think I wouldn't mind if they left it here now. Now, I don't want to be back in 3 years watching Scarlett Johansson again running away from a Distortus Rex or whatever other mutant dinosaur they think up of. But this is fine. Again, we can have that for the poster.
Do you get the sense that maybe there's a plan where they do kind of three movies with one cast and another three movies with a new cast? Because this is a good cast.
Yeah, maybe a little bit, you know, because I will say there's like, I'm not going to give anything away, but I don't think you really can give anything away with these kinds of films, because the minute you see the oily pharma guy, you're like, well, that guy is probably going to get eaten. But there is a sense towards the end of the film, there's this wonderful scene with one of the characters, I won't say who, and it is quite moving, and it's actually quite, okay, that's quite, you know, ballsy for a Jurassic World film. And then they kind of reverse things, and it's you can probably guess what I'm trying to say, but it's almost as if the studio was like, no, we can't get rid of these characters yet, because what if this is really successful and what if we can franchise this thing?
Of course not. And there's going to be, of course, they're working on this Beatles movie.
Beatles movies.
Yeah. Not a good idea getting an actual Beatle to kind of get involved with the scripting, I would have thought.
Yeah, but for some reason, Sam Mendes said, you know what, it's fine. I'll meet up with Ringo Starr. I'm sure he won't have that many edits. But apparently he did. They met up in April. They spent 2 days kind of discussing the script. Ringo Starr did this interview with the New York Times where he was talking about it and was very complimentary of the writer involved. Very good writer, great reputation. But basically he was taking issue with how himself and Maureen Cox's relationship was portrayed on screen. So made them change like loads of stuff around that because it didn't feel like true to their relationship at the time. To which, again, we've talked about it loads, but like the Michael Jackson biopic and stuff like that, and the family being involved, how do you create a movie out of that when people are so involved and so close to it and not really willing to take that step back from it? This would have me slightly worried. But then again, I mean, is the Ringo Starr film going to be the most successful out of the four Beatles films? Probably not. And people would argue that it is such a, sorry, Ringo, peace and love, as he'd say himself.
Yeah.
But it's such a, and again, there's an argument to be made for like, this is like a small part of his story. Although, I mean, you could argue like it's at the peak of his fame. Like they met in the 60s, they got married in the 60s, subsequently divorced in the 70s. But I can understand him also wanting to be precious about it, given that she has since passed and, you know, wanting to honour her legacy, for want of a better word, and stuff like that. But he said now that he's much more satisfied with how he's depicted in the script and that he sends director Sam Mendes peace and love. But then that has me worried as to like what, because they don't get into the specificities of what was changed. But he was just basically saying there were things that they were doing on screen that they would never do and things that they would never say and stuff like that. So I'm wondering.
When he says they, who does he mean?
He means himself and Maureen. Yeah.
Right, okay, so, but not him and the rest of the Beatles.
Not even the lads.
They're not going, Ringo, what do you think? Which never happened.
No, I don't think so. I think I think he's known to leave that well enough alone. So, yeah.
Yeah, okay. And Adrian Grenier is coming back for the Devil Wears
Prada. He's not.
That's okay, right. Okay, sorry.
The real
yes.
villain of the Devil Wears Prada. Is not coming back for Devil Wears Prada season 2, which I was not, or the sequel, to which I would say, like, obviously, when this was being reported as news, I was like, again, sorry, spoilers for the Devil Wears Prada, a film that came out a long time ago, but, you know, we chart Andy, who's played by Anne Hathaway, her relationship with this boyfriend who's not supportive of her working in fashion media and stuff like that, and they kind of break up, but the film ends and they're back on, like, better, they're in a better place, but it doesn't seem like they're going to get back together. Why would he be in the second film, which is focusing on Meryl Streep being like, the state of print media, what are we going to do? Like, why would Adrian Grenier be there? Why would he be there, respectfully?
Just to make cheese sandwiches.
But doesn't he go back to proper journalism at the end of the...
And that's what I'm saying, like, they are on, like, kind of better terms, but then, I don't know, like, give her a new love interest. Kenneth Branagh has joined the cast, which I'm like, who is he going to play? Maybe.
Whose love interest?
All the rest of them are back.
Andy's love interest. Anne Hathaway's love interest.
Is he been over? Is he been over?
No, it's a joke, yeah. Hopefully that's not the case, yeah.
All the rest of them are coming back, though. I think the production starts. It started this week. They're filming in New York and Italy, but like all the others have come back, as I said previously. So Meryl Streep, Emily Blunt, Anne Hathaway. Speaking of getting paid $10 to $20 million, probably. And Stanley Tucci, so.
Yeah, absolutely.
Watch this space for that.
I don't know. Yeah, I just
really
don't know.
No, it's going to be terrible. Our romanticisation of this needs to be studied, because we're being poisoned by nostalgia, I fear, and we really need to have a word with ourselves and sit down, because this is going to be bad. Like, yeah. If everyone's going to the cinema with the acceptance that it's not going to be good, fair enough. I'm not here to yuck yums, but like, let's not make it out like there's going to be anything else by that, you know?
I know, but people still go and see it. We just talked about the 9 millionth dinosaur movie, you know, so you know yourself.
Sick in the head.
Yeah. You are listening to the Moncrief Show on Newstalk. We're going to take a break, back in a couple of minutes. You are listening to the Moncrief Show on Newstalk. 087-1400-106 is our WhatsApp number. 75 grand in the cash machine. Let's see, did anyone pick up the phone?
Newstalk's Summer Cash Machine.
Ciarán nearly didn't answer our call last week, but I think it was probably a good idea that he did, because he became the recipient of the biggest cash prize ever given away on Irish radio. Well done, Ciarán. We're making our next call right now. There is a significant amount of cash up for grabs, so if you've entered since Ciarán won, check your phone, answer within five rings and tell us today's winning amount.
One ring. Two rings. Three rings. Four rings. Five rings.
It rarely happens these days, but it is one of those occasions. So what happens now? It means the next game is going to be a rollover, a lot more than €75,000. And if you've entered since last Friday at 5pm, you're already included, but you will need the correct cash total. Listen to the Hard Shoulder just after 5 to get that new cash amount, and we could be calling you.
Newstalk's Summer Cash Machine.
It also means someone's going to be staring at the phone this evening, wondering, was that it? Or I don't know what happens if it's, I must find out. If you don't, if you answer on the sixth ring, have we already hung up? And they're going, no, hello, it's me, it's 75 grand. Oh, God. That's torturous. Anyway, Jean, tell us about our second wine.
Our second wine. Okay, we're in California now. Just a little bit about the California wine industry, given that we're all in the, going to be in Trade Wars City next week, and it's going to be all over the news. There's over 400,000 people employed in the wine industry in California. It's the fourth largest producing country in the world, right?
Mm-hmm.
But actually, they've had a lot of, nothing to do with the politics. They've had a few difficult years, the wildfires. Their production levels are going down. They've been grubbing up a lot of vines. You know, the harvest is getting smaller. The impact of the heat is really hitting them. So it's, you know, genuinely, it hasn't been an ideal time for them. But saying that, I mean, I was at the California Wine Institute wine fair about 6-8 weeks ago in Dublin, and I tried some wines and they are absolutely incredible. Like, the quality is there. Now, they do tend to be in the upper price bracket.
Yes. And well, they've come a long way.
This would be as well, you know.
But though, actually, it's a good point. Why would an American wine be more notwithstanding what's just about to happen, why would an American wine be more expensive than one that comes in the new world?
The ex-seller prices are very high because it usually a lot, like, I mean, apart from the sort of, there's a lot of the cheap and cheerful stuff, but like, if you're looking at Napa, Sonoma, you know, the premium stuff, it all tends, their prices from the wineries are quite high anyway.
Yeah, okay.
And they tend to be more premium. And the quality is certainly there. I mean, it is fantastic quality. It really, really is. And I mean, like, a lot of them will be on restaurant lists because, you know, the Americans with the expense accounts will pay for it, you know.
Yeah.
And they're all working all over the world, you know, for all these various multinational companies, and they go out entertaining each other, and they go in and they will buy and pay because the company is paying for it for an expensive wine. So it all kind of feels, but the California wine industry, like, is going through quite a lot of changes and quite a lot of difficulties at the moment, you know. But saying that, the quality of the premium stuff is really worth. I mean, as I say, at the California Fair, like, you know, Chateau Montalino, which was the famous one from the judgment at Paris, you know, when the Californian wines, you know, kind of outclassed the French ones. And it's still absolutely made by a guy called Beau Barrett, who's actually of Irish ancestry, funnily enough. And it's really, really top class. I tried the Chardonnay and I went, oh my God, that is absolutely stunning.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
So.
But would they be that dependent on exporting wine?
No, a lot of it is in the home market well, you know, and because, like, there isn't a huge amount of it on this market because the ex-seller prices are so high.
Yeah.
So, and I mean, like, as I say, the statistics I've seen show that their key markets are Canada, Europe and China, funnily enough, and the United Kingdom. So, I mean, where this is all going to go. But look, they still have a very strong home market and there's a lot of wealth in the United States.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, so, particularly in California.
Yeah, so they like, I think they should be all right. But anyway, a little bit, but this is The Frog's Leap from Napa Valley and it's Zinfandel and it's the 2021 and it's available from Wheeler & Wines, wheelerandwines.ie and in their shop in Loughlin Sound. Now, Zinfandel is related to a Croatian grape called Kračnik. Oh. That's my poor attempt to at the pronunciation. But it's also Primitivo from the south of Italy.
Ah,
they both have the same parent, right?
Oh, and who was the original parent?
Croatia.
Oh.
And so what happened was that in the 19th century, the vine somehow, during actually the Gold Rush years, the vine, one went to Puglia, went south to the south of Italy. The other went to California and was brought over by immigrants and who planted it because they wanted a taste of home. And the next thing, it's become the sort of, I suppose, indigenous grape of California. And I mean, we don't have the time, but there's wonderful stories about Zinfandel. But it's a big, powerful red grape and it makes absolutely stunning wines. It's a good firm tannin, high alcohol and spice. Now, Frog's Leap farm their Zinfandel in Santa Helena, which is just north of their home in Rutherford's, in two vineyards, White Barn and Molinari. And, they've got the sort of gravel soil that Zinfandel just absolutely loves. But this wine is actually a blend of 81% Zinfandel, 10% Petit Syrah and 9% Carignan. And it's concentrated fruit flavours, lovely blackberry, bramble, black pepper and clove on the nose. And then, this has got an elegant structure, integrated tannins, a nice acidity. And, you know, it's a very bold expression of Zinfandel. So, like, this is going to be in a restaurant list that somebody with a very big expense account is going to have a very expensive steak with.
Yeah.
And have a wonderful evening.
Yeah. Oh, no, it's absolutely lovely
Really, the quality is there. And the producer is John Williams and he is owns the estate. And he has been creating some of the most exciting wines from the Napa Valley in recent years.
But it's interesting that a grape like Zinfandel and even Primitivo, you can get a really nice one or you can get one that just bashes you over the head.
Absolutely. Yeah.
It depends what you
like
do
anything.
With it.
If you know what you're doing, then you're away in a hack.
Yeah.
You know? And this guy knows what he's doing. John Williams knows what he's doing.
Yeah.
And this is a super wine.
Yeah. Okay. That's lovely. Christopher Nolan has made the movie of the Odyssey, has he? Or where are we at with that?
I think he's still making it. I think he's still hacking away at it, I'm pretty sure. But basically, it's not a full trailer either, is the thing. There's been some misreporting around this. There's a teaser trailer that's being shown only in cinemas before the new Jurassic World about the Odyssey. People aren't familiar. This is his next thing after Oppenheimer. Tells the story of Odysseus. I didn't do classics in school. I don't know if that's how you say it. Played by Matt Damon. He's the king of Ithaca. He's trying to get back from the Trojan War and he's encountering all these mythical creatures and it's all, you know, gods and stuff like that. It's telling this story, hugely epic, but this teaser has gone out and obviously because it's cinemas only, you know, that's when leaks start happening and people are recording it and putting it up online and then there's people kind of making weird AI stuff as well to go along with it or whatever. It's not good. And people are kind of making their minds up about this film as well, even though it only started filming in March. So they're definitely still not done. They're probably nearly done, but like they're definitely still not done. Huge cast, typical of Christopher Nolan film. You've mentioned Matt Damon already, Tom Holland, Anne Hathaway, Robert Pattinson, John Bernthal, Zendaya, loads and loads and loads of people. But basically, it's also sparked this debate now because we're talking about ancient Greece. You know, they're filming in apparently these also in Italy and these Sicilian islands that Homer was apparently, or that's where he thought of the story, something like that. Everyone in this teaser trailer is speaking in an American accent, to which people are saying, so what is it then? Are we in ancient Greece or are we in
Boston.
America, you know what I mean? And it's the people are, and then I'm kind of like doesn't really matter when it's an interpretation of like a classic story. And then it is also like, if you, he's talked about how much he wants it to be as close to the thing as possible. I suppose it kind of is a fair argument to be like, you've a lot of very capable actors. Could you put on an accent? Could we get the dialect coach in, you know?
Well, I think it would probably be weird if they all kind of were putting in some sort of weirdy Greek accent.
Yeah, there is also that, and I think I would, and that's the argument that I would rather people actually act to the best of their abilities and focus on that and speak in whatever their American accents, as opposed to like really trying to work on perfecting this classical Greek accent that like, they probably can't nail.
Yeah, because sometimes they do, you know, they do things in a kind of a neutral, almost English sounding accent when it's something historical, which that kind of. That seems to be more acceptable when they do that.
Yeah.
Odysseus is played by Matt Damon.
Yes.
he looks the part, like from shots that were leaked of the production of the film. Like he's beefed up for this, and he really does. Like I was going to say, he looks like Odysseus. We don't know what he looks like.
Yeah.
But he's certainly effective.
And all the popular depictions.
But
of
I think
him,
you can. I think with accent wise, you can go too far the other way sometimes, and you can just have a bunch of very famous American and English actors doing that faux Shakespearean thing. If the material and if the film is good enough, you'll forget about it. Think, for example, Chernobyl. And think about the fact that you had Jared Harris, you had Jesse Buckley, Barry Keoghan, all in their natural Irish, British, Scottish accents, and you just forgot about it after 5 minutes because it was that effective. So I prefer for the performances to be decent. At the same time, do I want like a Denzel New York Gladiator sort of situation?
Yeah.
That's maybe a bit too distracting.
You can't suspend your disbelief then.
I do like that he's shown the trailer just in cinemas though. Because that harks back to like Batman in 1989. In 1988, you had a trailer, like a 30-second teaser for the original Batman film. And the films that were out in cinemas that summer that the trailer was attached to, their box office revenue was through the roof because people were queuing around the box just to see that trailer. So I like that he's doing that.
Okay. It's a good way to get people to go.
Yeah.
Bums in seats.
Yeah.
I suppose, yeah. I'll reserve judgment.
Yeah,
I don't know what he's going to do with a story that old that's kind of different or... And if he's just trying to tell the original story, because it's almost like there's been so many adaptations or versions of the story told in different forms, like kids' cartoons and, what's he going to bring to it?
Yeah, I don't know if I care enough, but it's a very like starry cast. But then I'm also like, is that enough?
I'm really looking forward to it. My dad read us a massive doorstopper of a book, a children's version of the Odyssey when we were kids. He used to read a few pages of it to my brother and I every night. So I'm really looking forward to it because it's just that, you know, nostalgia factor for me. Yeah. Nostalgia factor about the Odyssey, that's weird. I remember the original. But also, there was another Odyssey film this year. There was one with Ralph Fiennes and Juliette Binoche. Yeah.
Okay.
They got there first.
More than one of them. Depending on what part of Catalonia you're from, says the texter, the letter X at the beginning of a word can be pronounced like sh or ch in English.
Okay, well, I didn't speak Spanish.
Yeah, sorry.
Thank you for that anyway.
Okay. Can you ask your wine expert why does Saint-Emilion Grand Cru taste so different to lots of other Merlots? It seems to have a particularly distinct taste. I didn't think Saint-Emilion was a Merlot. Personally?
No, Saint-Emilion is on the right bank of Bordeaux, and it's most of the left bank, which is Medoc, is a blend of Cabernet Sauvignon, Merlot, and Cabernet Franc, and various other grape varieties. In Saint-Emilion, Merlot is the dominant, so it will be up to 80% Merlot. Now, I don't know; it's probably to do with quality levels. You know, I don't know which Saint-Emilion you're drinking. Certainly, some of the great, and I've been looking.
Well, it's a Grand Cru, they're saying. So,
yeah, the Grand Cru is usually means will be a sort of a fairly high good quality level, but it could be a wine that has a fault. There could be a fault and you just didn't pick up on it. So I don't know is the answer. I'd have to taste the wine myself.
Yeah, okay. And somebody else says wineries use Innis glass to clear a wine of sediment. It's made of fish swim bladders, so it's not vegan friendly. Gosh.
But what I said is, you know, there are the non-vegan wines are the ones that are using the isinglass, which is the fish guts, basically, to find the wines, as they call it, to filter the wines. But now the Kieselgur, which is this earth which performs the same, is not made from an animal-based product. So that means they can call it a vegan wine.
Yeah. This person says it's called Diomatius Earth. Or DE for short.
Yeah.
We knew that. Right, let's move on to our second movie. It's called The Shrouds. Here's a clip.
You own a restaurant in a cemetery. That says something, don't you think?
I'm part owner of the cemetery tomb. It's kind of a showcase for my business. Does that say more?
Well, I think that the decor in here says something, although I'm not sure what. Those ominous metallic ninja things.
Those are the shrouds.
Shrouds? You mean like burial shrouds?
Yes.
Ooh. Hmm. Even that clip sounds like they're trying a bit too hard to make it sound scary.
Yeah, there's dialogue in this film that no human being has ever come out with in the history of human beings speaking. Yeah, I really did struggle with this, which is such a shame because it's a David Cronenberg film. I love David Cronenberg's films. And I also like the place that this is coming from, that, you know, that this is such a personal and delicate project for him. Story-wise, you have Vincent Cassel there on what I should say is the worst date in the history of worst dates. It's because he is a wealthy widower who is about to tell, I think that's maybe the first time he's gone out with someone since his wife died, that his wife is dead. But not just that, he owns the restaurant that they're actually eating in, and he also owns the graveyard. Why would you put a restaurant next to a graveyard next door?
I didn't know you could own a graveyard.
Yeah. He owns this graveyard, Grave Tech, it's called. And basically, he's this, it's never really fully explained how he made his fortune, but he's a wealthy businessman who has invested his fortune into something called Grave Tech. And he mentioned shrouds there, and his shrouds, basically very wealthy clients pay after they've died to be wrapped in these elaborate shrouds, which have cameras all over them, and they're put into the ground. They have these very elaborate, very expensive gravestones that live stream images of your loved one's decomposing corpses.
What a business idea.
It's ghastly. It's really ghastly. And just after that scene there, he takes that first date, that poor woman, down to the graveyard and says, would you like to see pictures of my ex-wife? And she thinks she's going to see old holiday snaps.
I'm guessing you didn't get the ride that night.
No, he did not. He did not get that or a second date. Moving on. So this poor guy is just obsessed with keeping his wife's memory alive. And he should probably go see a therapist instead. He invests everything, all of his attention, all of his money into this tech. He's also been keeping a close friendship with his wife, Becca's twin sister. So you have Becca and Terry, both played by Dan Kruger. So you have these really weird scenes where you've got these dream sequences where his wife keeps coming back to him after these horrible visits to a doctor. Every time his wife visits him in these dreams, she's missing a limb. She had cancer, she went to see her doctor, but it's like the doctor's kind of amputating body parts every time. It's a body horror, it's a Cronenberg film.
Sure.
Yeah, there's a lot of that in this. But in real life, he's developing this way too close relationship with Becca's twin. Anyway, one day, the graveyard, Grey Tech, is vandalized and hacked. And, you know, Karsh, that's Vincent Cassel's character, he's thinking to himself, who could have done this? There are lots of candidates. There's a lot of controversy over this technology.
I love that Vincent Cassel is the good guy.
He's wondering, like, is
the relatable hero.
He's wondering, is this a competitor, because there are competitors in this business who did this? Is it a wealthy client who's annoyed? Is it a loved one who's annoyed? Or is it actually Becca's sister's ex-husband, played by Guy Pearce, who is a very unstable individual, and he actually assembled the technology. He helped Karsh assemble the technology. I'm making it sound a little bit more complicated than it is. It's actually a bit more straightforward. Is it effective? No. I found this to be a very like David Cronenberg has definitely made ickier films. Ickier films. But I don't think he's made one quite as lifeless, and that's a terrible point, I apologize for, as The Shrouds, because it's just, there's no life to this thing. It's far too dry. I think it's maybe designed as a bit of a satire, while Cronenberg film isn't. But I don't think the satirical elements are working. The exchanges are they're a little too chewy. They're a bit too contrived. The plot twist didn't really work for me. It's not a great looking film at times. There's a lot of Cronenberg in it, even in Vincent Cassel's character, you know, the slick back grey hair, the t-shirts with the blazers, the way he moves, the way he talks very, very carefully, it's Cronenberg. You can imagine Cronenberg on the side of the set saying, you know, talking maybe about his wife and talking about grief. And if this is, you know, and I salute Cronenberg for, you know, going away and channeling his grief into, you know, his art. I think that's quite effective. There's a lot of talented people involved in this, but I just don't think it works. It's over stylized, it's too theatrical, and it also, like, the female characters in this thing, like, you know, a lot has gone into, you know, Guy Pearce's character, Vincent Cassel's. The women are just there to be slept with and to just, you know,
talk to the guys and make them feel better or make them feel yeah. It's weird. It just didn't really sit well with me at all. And Diane Kruger is asked to do some unfortunate things in this film, and it also features one of the clumsiest sex scenes I've seen. You know, remember the this is a weird thing, but you know the sex scene in Oppenheimer?
Yeah.
And there's a lot of reading and taking books off of shelves, and it's worse than that.
Okay. Oh god. Yeah. So one of the co-creators of The Last of Us has left.
Yeah.
Is that a sign of tension? Are things not happy?
So this is Neil Druckmann. He's left. Co-creator Craig Mazin is staying on. He's the sole showrunner ahead of the third season. I think they still get on fine. Druckmann is saying that they, because he's works with the studio as well that created the games of The Last of Us, and they have a new game coming out and he wants to put like all the focus into that. It's called Intergalactic: The Heretic Prophet, and he says now is the right time to step away because there's kind of everything's done with season two and no meaningful work has started on season three. Now you could also look at it as if to be like, well, also nobody watched season two. That's a slight over exaggeration.
And but season like, three is going to be like a completely, it's set in the same universe, but
set in the same universe, like completely separate story up until what we've experienced. And I'm trying to tread carefully here again, but yeah, I mean, I think the ratings decline was a shock to people as well, despite everything that goes on in the games and the show. I don't think people expected it. I think I talked about it on the show a couple of weeks ago that, like, I think
she gave away the whole thing. Totally gave away the whole thing. They're still in the office writing apology letters to people.
Moving past that, but the viewership from episode one to like the final episode fell by like 50% in the States.
Whoa,
like it was a huge drop. So you're kind of wondering then, is it like, okay, I'm out to avoid any further of that? I'm not really sure, but yeah.
Yeah, we can speculate about that.
We'd love speculating.
Yeah, we can, of course. Thank you all very much. Fionnuala Jones, Gene Smullen and Chris Wasser. That's our lot.
Moncrief, weekdays at 2 p.m. on News Talk.